So why in the world would we want to study the book of Esther? What in the world could Esther have to do with our lives and our situation in 2016? Well, Esther's in the Bible, so that's a really good reason to study it. But that has not always been a good enough reason. I was doing some background research this week, and I discovered that Esther has not always been a very popular book. And this was new to me. For about the first 7 centuries of the Christian church, there were no commentaries written on the book of Esther at all. John Calvin never preached from it. And for Presbyterians, we step back and we say, whoa. I looked in my set of commentaries. It's not there. He did not preach from it, did not write any commentaries on it. Martin Luther... Martin Luther is, he's a good guy. We like him a lot. But he didn't care for the book of James. So you always got to, keep that in mind. But Luther denounced Esther along with 2 Maccabees, which, by the way, is in the Apocrypha, which we don't preach from. But for some reason, he lumped Esther in with that. And he said that Esther was full of heathen unnaturalities. So what was the big deal? What was the problem with Esther? Well, there are some unusual things in Esther. One of them, God's name is never mentioned. Not the general name of God, Elohim, or, the covenant name of God, Jehovah, Yahweh. Neither one of them is mentioned. There's no mention of the temple. There's no mention of Jerusalem. No one prays in Esther. They fast. They don't pray. There are no visions. They don't talk about the law. There are no miracles. And in fact, the characters themselves, you look at the main characters, Mordecai and Esther, and there's some decisions you kind of question a little bit. I'm not sure if I would have done that. And the text never comments about it. So, you could kind of see why maybe people might have questioned whether this is really a good idea to study this book. Now, having said all that, besides the fact that it is in the Bible, I'm convinced that Esther is a beneficial and a really important book for us to study at this point in time in our history. History of the world, the country where we're at, and our church. And I want to give you 2 reasons for that. One of them is that Esther gives us a God who works behind the scenes. The God in Esther, which is the true God, is the only God, but the God that is presented in Esther doesn't come out on center stage. He doesn't announce himself, obviously, because his name's not even mentioned. He doesn't, work through flash and fire and a miracle, but he works in the background through ordinary, flawed people and through everyday events. And but in doing that, he works. And he works to preserve his people, and he works to build his kingdom. And what I think is wonderful about that is that's exactly what we need, because that's exactly what we have. We live within a culture where God does not choose to do things in a really obvious way. Now, these guys are testimonies to the fact that God still works miracles. But most people, standing back from looking at them would say, oh, well, those aren't miracles, they got some weird thing they call religion, and, it's working for them right now. God does work miracles, but he doesn't choose to do it in the same way he did in the Old Testament and the New Testament, generally. Sometimes he does, and in some places he does, but not nearly as much. And so Esther, I think, is helpful for us. The other thing about Esther is, besides the fact that Esther was within a culture that was about as diametrically opposed to what she believed as could be. And could you not say the same thing about our culture today? It's going as fast as possible in the opposite direction. All we have to do is stand still, and we're moving against it. Now, the other thing is that Esther shows us what it looks like to live a distinctive life in the world without giving in and without becoming like it. And today we're going to get a glimpse of that. We're going to get a little slice of this, one aspect of that, and that is living in the land of excess. So let me give you a little background. The story of Esther begins really earlier in the history of God's people. And by the way, just so you know, full disclosure, I'm going to have a little more history today, kind of a background. This is sort of an introductory sermon. So if you're not into history, well, hopefully you know, you'll warm up to it. And if you do, great, you know, you're happy. So the nation of Israel was originally founded as one nation. After Solomon's reign, it split into two. So you had Israel in the north, Judah in the south. Israel very quickly drifted off. 722 BC, they get carried off to Assyria, and they're done. They're history. You don't hear any more about them, except, you know, through the Samaritans in Jesus' day. The southern kingdom of Judah ended up lasting 140 years longer, all the way to 586 BC. They, too, go into exile to Babylon. But that's just the beginning, really, of this story. Well, Babylon under King Nebuchadnezzar was probably the most powerful nation on earth. You had the Hanging Gardens, one of the wonders of the world. But under his grandson Belshazzar, very quickly took steps downward and declined. And you may know the story from Daniel, the book of Daniel. Belshazzar held this great feast one night, and this is when the phrase, the handwriting on the wall, you know, really was literally true. So this hand shows up writing on the wall, and he doesn't know what it says, but finds out from Daniel that it essentially says, your kingdom has been weighed in the balances and found wanting. In other words, dude, your history. That's sort of modern parlance. And Belshazzar ends up being captured and killed that night, and Babylon falls. So that very night, October 12, 539 BC, Cyrus the Great, Cyrus II, conquered the Babylonian Empire with, well, definitely without firing a shot, but without even engaging in battle. They diverted the Euphrates River, entered the city through its canals. But the amazing thing, and I did not know this before recently, was that he was welcomed as a liberator in Babylon by the Babylonians, which I guess tells us about Belshazzar and what kind of a ruler he was. And so that began the Persian Empire. So Cyrus is, and you may remember that it was the Medo-Persian Empire. Cyrus's father was a Persian, his mother was a Mede. So very strategic person in history to bring these two kingdoms together into the Medo-Persian Empire. Well, that same year, 539, he decreed that the Jews who were captive in Babylon could return to their homeland. And he did that not only with the Jews, but he did that with a number of other people groups. And he organized and financed their return, which is amazing. Cyrus is the only king in the Bible to be called my anointed. It's the same title given to the Messiah. Now, most of the Jews did return in that, you know, in that return 539, so, you know, a few years after that. They attempted to rebuild their city, their lives, their temple, their homes. But it was not by any stretch a majority. Most of the Jews actually stayed back in Babylon. I mean, could you blame them? You know, you stay, you have a pretty good life, or you can go and possibly die, starve, you know, whatever. It's a very, very difficult decision to go back to Judah. So that's, you know, that's where that point in history. Fast forward 50 years, and now you get to the time of Esther. And so Esther is focusing on the people, the Jews that were still in Babylon. 50 years, isn't that, well, it's not Babylon. It's still in the Persian Empire. And they were in danger of assimilating into Persian culture. They had not heard from God or his prophets for a long time. And so this generation, Esther's generation, needed to know that, A, God cared about them, and B, that he would protect them. But they also needed to know what it looked like to be faithful to him. So enter the whole reason for the book of Esther. Now, one of the things I find fascinating is, what was going on during Esther's day all around the world? In China, Confucius lived and taught. Greece was in its golden age in the time of Esther. Pericles' political system was becoming the basis of our modern democracy at that time. Socrates was born in that general time period. Pythagoras, for all you math people, I am not one of them. Pythagoras wrote his mathematical theorems. Isn't that exciting for all you math people? You know, this was happening. But with all of that going on, God's attention was in two places, one in Jerusalem, Judah, and in Persia. That's what he cared about when everybody else was looking elsewhere. So I want to pick up the story in the citadel of Susa. This is modern Iran. King Ahasuerus, whose Greek name was King Xerxes, and that's a lot easier to pronounce, so I'm going to use Xerxes if you guys don't mind. He's the son of Darius, who Daniel served. He's the father of Artaxerxes, who Nehemiah served. So that kind of gets you positioned in, you know, where in history we fall. His kingdom stretched from modern Pakistan in the east to modern Turkey to the west. So I want to show you just three aspects of the excess that was going on there in these first nine verses. First, a kingdom of opulence. There's a little outline in your bulletin if you want to follow along. Xerxes came to power in 486 BC. He was 32 years old. And the events in Esther take about 10 years. So this begins in the third year of his reign, 483 BC. At the time, Persia is in conflict with Greece in the west. Greece and Persia were essentially the two superpowers of the day. Okay, if you grew up in the 1980s, you know, it was like the U.S. and the USSR. So they were, Persia's wealth was unbelievable, and that was an indicator of her power, one way to measure power. Alexander the Great actually conquered Persia a little over 100 years later. When he entered the palace of Susa, he discovered 1,200 tons of gold and silver bullions. Now, I can't even picture 1,200. What does 1,200 tons look like? It's incredible. And this was at the end of the Persian Empire when they had been defeated. You can only imagine what Xerxes had, you know, back in this time. 1,200 tons of gold and silver bullions, 270 tons of minted gold coins just in the palace at Susa. And when you hear the description in this passage of the curtains and all the... Does it not take you back, if you're familiar with the Old Testament, to the description in Exodus of the tabernacle or the description in Kings of the temple, the detail, the beauty? You get a little bit of that right here. So, and again, Susa was one capital. There actually were four of this entire Persian Empire. So this was a land of excess. Fair to say, not a whole lot of dispute there. I was thinking about the fact that the church has always existed, at least in part, in the middle of luxury. You know, the church as we know it, New Testament, was birthed in the midst of the Roman Empire. Now, the Roman Empire was notorious not only for their wealth but for their decadence. You know, it was a declining, in a sense, empire, but just incredibly, incredibly wealthy. And you know, there have been times in the church's history where the church itself was incredibly wealthy, in the time before the Reformation. And it's interesting when you think about the church's spiritual strength and her physical wealth are almost always an inverse relationship. You know, when the church had the most physically, they were absolutely at the bottom spiritually. And when they had the least physically, financially, that was when God was most present and most powerful. And so it's not an accident. The Bible warns us of the desire for wealth, the pursuit of wealth. It doesn't warn us about wealth itself. Wealth itself is a blessing. But the desire and the pursuit of wealth are really dangerous. And, you know, I just think it's striking that we're in a very similar situation to the situation in Esther today. You know, we live in one of the wealthiest nations on earth. But guess what? It's also one of the most immoral nations on earth. You know, when you go to different places in the world, you know, when I went to Nepal, you know, these people there have iPhones. They know who Miley Cyrus is. We have exported all kinds of stuff, some of it good and a lot of it not so good. We in the church in America have to recognize the danger of this idea that great wealth is normal. See, I think this prevailing attitude that because we're a great nation, and I agree that we're a great nation, that Yeah, to be wealthy, that's normal, that's expected. And is somehow tied to that is the idea that wealth is somehow our right. You see, the Bible calls us to hold our things loosely, doesn't it? We're called to give away our money generously so that we don't become captivated by it. And we'll get back to that in a minute. The second thing I want to show you in this passage is Xerxes shows us an attitude of hubris. Hubris is just another word for good old-fashioned pride. When I first read this, I was talking to John about this last week. I had a hard time picturing, how do you have a feast for 6 months? You ever wonder about that? That's a lot of turkey, you know, or beef or whatever. A lot of wine. I could imagine a feast for 6 hours, but I mean, this was 6 months. It just staggers the imagination. Well, some scholars actually think he didn't have it for 6 months. It was just sort of a, you know, symbolic hyperbole, whatever. I think he actually did. And there's a one scholar named Karen Jobes who made a lot of sense in explaining that there was a council, because it's called the Great War Council of 483, where the historian Herodotus told us that Xerxes held this six-month council for his leaders of the empire. And he was planning to invade Greece. So this is a military council. He's trying to drum up support for this campaign against Greece because they're constantly back and forth, attacking each other. So he gathered all of his nobles, all of his officials, his military leaders, his princes, his governors of all these provinces, and he's trying to rally support for this military campaign. So during the 6 months of the council, what Xerxes is doing is he's parading before, you know, succeeding groups of people, because that's a lot of people, all of his vast wealth. And the reason he's doing that, he's trying to consolidate these men. He's trying to show them, hey, you want a piece of the pie? Then come with me to Greece and you know, let's deal with them once and for all. So if you fight for me, this is some of what is going to be yours. So Herodotus actually has a quote from Xerxes at this council. Xerxes said he intended to, quote, lead my army through Europe to Greece that I may punish the Athenians for what they've done to the Persians and to my father. It was not granted him to punish them. Darius, you know, was defeated in battle by the Greeks. I, on his and all the Persians' behalf, will never rest till I have taken and burnt Athens. This is how you shall best please me. Whosoever comes with his army best equipped shall receive from me such gifts as are reckoned most precious among us. So, just think about the hubris of this guy. He's on a vendetta to destroy Greece because they embarrassed his father. And he's dragging the entire nation with him, and he's putting his wealth on the line. But furthermore, he's asking these people essentially to put their lives on the line. And he does it with the crassest of motives. You know, he doesn't inspire them with love of country or patriotism or, you know, the fatherland or the motherland or whichever they preferred. But he just lays before them all of this money and says, okay, give your life to me and you can be rich. Won't that be great? Especially if you die. I was thinking about this when I heard an interview the other day with Julian Assange, who is the founder of WikiLeaks. He's been in the news a good bit lately. But Julian Assange is an amazing guy, besides the fact he's been in exile for several years and wanted by who knows how many world governments. But he hacked into a number of secure, I believe, websites or agencies of the U.S. government at the age of 16. I mean, I knew he had done stuff more recently, but he started early. And he's released thousands and thousands of pages of documents over the years. And his, you know, his stated goal, his desire is he wants to blow the whistle on corruption. Wherever there's corruption, he wants to reveal it. So obviously that gets him into hot water with a lot of government people. But and according to him, by the way, he has been cleared of all the charges against him. So I'm just sort of taking his word for it. But what I found most interesting about this interview was the interviewer asked him, what have you learned? You know, give us a snippet of what you've learned about people in government. And he said, you know, what I found is that the people at the lower levels of government are usually really good people. They're just doing their job. They're hardworking. They usually have integrity. But he said, as you get up the ladder of power in a government, he said, the people become increasingly duplicitous. And you know, I just thought that was kind of sad. But really, is that not pretty much our experience? With however long you've been alive, the stories that you've heard about people in government and what they do. And isn't it true, you know, doesn't it jive with what the Bible says about the effects of money and power on us as human beings? It doesn't take much power to corrupt. You know, how do we know that? Well, because it happens in the church. And we all know the church doesn't have a whole lot of power, but it's very, very common for people in the church, you know, to get a little area of what they conceive of as power, and it becomes their fiefdom. And it's amazing to me because that happens even in small churches where it's like relative, the power is just minuscule. But it just tells us about the human heart. Whatever authority we wield has got to be used for the good of others. And, of course, Xerxes is a good negative example of that. All right, the last thing I want to show you is an atmosphere of indulgence. At the end of the 180 days, Xerxes gave a shorter banquet of 7 days for those that were in Susa that were basically helping him to entertain all these other dignitaries. And this is where we hear the details about the curtains and about the marble and about the architecture, the precious stones, the gold and silver couches. What many kingdoms kept in locked vaults, Xerxes just kind of passed out for everybody to use. You know, you have these priceless gold goblets where each one is different from the other. And they're just, you know, they're just chugging the wine down right out of these goblets. Wine, it says, was lavished according to the bounty of the king. There was only one rule, and that was there is to be no compulsion. Now, what does that mean? The only rule is that there are no rules. So anyone at the king's banquet could eat or drink as much as he wanted to. Nobody was to be refused anything. Now, we already know this, you know, what's the goal? He's not just doing this because he's a nice guy. He wants to impress his subjects. He wants to consolidate his power. Now, let's try to make a comparison here. We don't live in Persia. We don't live in a place like the Palace of Susa. But let's ask ourselves a question. Do we live in an atmosphere of indulgence in America? Well, let's see. This is the beginning of football season. And tonight at 8:30, kind of an important start. You know, this is when one particular team gets started. And we're all very curious about that. But, you know, when you watch football games, there's a lot of commercials. And the commercials are really telling about our society and what it values, what it, you know, what it prizes. You have one category of commercials would be for medication. You have, you know, every imaginable medication to cure every imaginable malady that you could have. And it seems like in football games, there's certain kinds of maladies that are focused on. I'm not going to go into that here. There was another category that kind of struck me. I was listening on the radio the other day to a commercial for a local used car dealership. I won't mention their name in case any of you work for them. But this commercial, they're saying, asking you the question, are you stuck in a lease that you're really tired of? You know, are you driving a car that you hate? Then break out. Break out of that lease. Break out of that loan. They said, we'll get you out of your loan even if you owe thousands of dollars more than your car is worth. And I'm listening to this commercial, and I'm thinking to myself, wait a minute. What happens after you let me break out of my loan where I owe thousands more than my car is worth? I know that you're not just donating this money to me, okay? What happens after that? Okay, I break out of my loan, and guess what? You shackle me with another one. And then in 5 years, I'm going to be in the same position, only worse this time. They went on in that commercial to say, if you make $350 a week, you can get $30,000 in credit. Do you know how long it takes somebody who makes $350 a week to pay off $30,000 in credit? Far too long. It's slavery. But what, you know, what's the rule? There is no compulsion. It's just like Xerxes. The only rule, there are no rules. And we have the effects of this atmosphere of indulgence all across our country. And, you know, these guys have been highlighting it for us. New Hampshire is number 2 in binge drinking among 12 to 20-year-olds in the country. 12 to 20-year-olds. We have an opioid epidemic that's out of control, which is 385 deaths from opioids in 2015. And it's been going up like that. But what I think is so powerful about what Teen Challenge is doing and what New Life Home is doing, the rate of success that these two programs have is astronomically better than all of the other programs that have all the funding in the world. But you know what they're doing? They're showing young men and young women that there's only one true source of pleasure, and that's Jesus Christ. It's not going to come through these other things. You see, we, as God's people, have to re-examine how we look at our possessions. Because these messages are getting shouted into our ears day after day, week after week. I want to close with this. Scholar Karen Jobes pointed out something that I thought was really fascinating about this war council that Xerxes had in 483 BC. The original readers of Esther, remember Esther, you know, when we read Esther in the Bible, we're reading the events, but Esther was actually a book, and there was a first audience, the first people that read Esther. The first people that read Esther were Jews living in Persia between the death of Xerxes and the time of Alexander the Great, somewhere in there, not exactly sure when. Those people that first read that story would have known something that we don't know about Xerxes. You see, when he went off to do his war with Greece, he came back 4 years later, guess what? Defeated and broke. Relatively broke. Still had 1,200 tons of whatever, gold sitting in the castle, but his wealth severely depleted. And discouraged and defeated. So the people that read Esther for the first time, they already knew that. And so the author introduces us to Xerxes not at the end of that, but before. Before, when he's in all of his former glory. So the fact that he didn't tell, that he doesn't mention that, when these readers know it, they're keeping this in the back of their minds. You see, the Jews that are reading this, they knew that they were in Persia for a reason. They were in Persia because their forefathers cared more about money, possessions, you know, wealth, than loving God and obeying his law. And so hearing about Xerxes and hearing about all of the splendor that he displayed to all of his leaders and knowing how he himself was going to be undone 4 years down the road would have caused them to look at the events in Esther a little bit more carefully, don't you think? A man named Haman and all that happens with him, they would pay attention and think, hey, wait a minute, there's a pattern here. Love of wealth and pride of position lead to ruin. You see, Israel learned that, didn't they? Both in the north and in the south. Babylon's Belshazzar learned that. Xerxes eventually learned that. One question is, will America learn that? Well, the jury's still out. Time will tell. But you see, we as the Church of Jesus Christ, we have to learn this lesson. Our only trust is in God's riches in Jesus Christ. That's it. It's our only place of safety. It's not in our possessions. It's not in our wealth or our status. It's not in the wealth or the history or the heritage even of our nation. You see, we have a lot of people, including many Christians, it's a great temptation for us to make a God out of our nation, as great as our nation is. We run the risk of trying to advance God's purposes through one nation's political process. And you know what? It's never going to work. Never has and it never will. Esther has great riches in store for us. And Xerxes' riches are just a picture. They're just a symbol. But the riches of Esther are the riches of the wisdom of the Word of God. So let's not ignore them. Let's pray together. God in heaven, I thank you that you give us a great picture in the scriptures of what it means to be self-absorbed. And we look around us and we see that, and we look inside and we experience the temptation to live life for ourselves, for what this life can offer. But Lord, our brothers that are sitting here with us have experienced the dead-end street that it is. And many of us have too in different ways. So Father, I thank you that the good news of the gospel tells us that there is only one sure and certain source of satisfaction, and that is Jesus Christ in the gospel. And Lord, I thank you that we can celebrate that today. And I pray that, Lord, if there's anyone here that does not have that sure basis for peace, that they would find it today. Father, thank you for speaking to us through your word. In Jesus' name, amen.